Morning. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, and as always, we are wishing you the best. We have a lot of classes and workshops going on right now, a very, very busy winter schedule. We sent out our newsletter yesterday with the listing of the winter schedule. If you'd like to be on the newsletter, it's 100% free. You just go to naturalnurse.com and put nothing but your email in the lower left-hand corner. You click on register for the newsletter, and then you just put in your email, no other questions asked, and then you get our emailings. And what we sent yesterday is a long list of many of the things that we're doing exactly now. For instance, last night in West Palm Beach, we gave a lecture about natural sex. So it was from the book, The Natural Guide to Great Sex, which is one of our many books. And we talked about herbs, homeopathics, testing of different kinds of things, like what kinds of estrogen, testosterone, progesterone to get tested for. So if you'd like your hormones to be more in balance, it's really good to have a baseline so that you know where you're coming from. For instance, would you want more black cohosh or more chaste tree berry? Well, who knows, unless you know your estrogen dominance or progesterone level, because those herbs support the body's production of different hormones. So it's more complex than people think. Today we're having a lecture. In a couple days we're doing the Miami Vegans. That's an open and free presentation to people in the area of Fort Lauderdale. So those are on ground. Online, we have lots and lots of things. For instance, we have the Magnificent Woman series on immediately, right now, and that is 100% free. You just go to naturalnurse.com, click calendar, and you can come on board for the Magnificent Woman series. That is a free presentation. We also have one coming up called The Eyes Have It, in terms of natural remedies for eye health. And then starting in March, we have the Natural Nurse Herbal Certification Course, which actually gives you a certificate in natural medicine. And if you are a health professional, it gives you 18 CE credits. Fully recognized CE credits if you are a nurse, a midwife, a nurse practitioner, a massage therapist, an acupuncturist, or a nutritionist. All of those people get 18 CE credits for taking the Natural Nurse Herbal Certification Course. If you're not a professional, you can take the course and you'll still get a certificate from Florida School of Holistic Medicine acknowledging that you did take the course for 18 CE credits, even though you don't need 18 CE credits if you don't have a license. In any event, just go to naturalnurse.com. You can look at books. You can look at calendar, where all the presentations are listed, both online and on ground. And we love to hear from you. So thank you so much for joining us today. We have as our guest Felicia Stoller, and she is known as America's Health and Wellness Expert. She's an RD, which is a registered dietitian, nutritionist, as well as having expanded her knowledge as an exercise physiologist and consultant in disease prevention, wellness, and healthful living. She also has a master's degree, Master's of Science, in Applied Physiology and Nutrition from Columbia University, and she has a doctorate in clinical nutrition from my alma mater, Rutgers School of Health Professions. She completed her residency at Rutgers, also Athletics and NBC News Medical Unit. She has served as a lecturer at Rutgers and also teaches exercise physiology, nutrition, and communication. She's been on the media quite a bit, as well as right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, where she has been here in the past. And she also did the groundbreaking series, Honey, We're Killing the Kids, which looked at unhealthy lifestyles of families across the country. So thank you so much for joining us today, Felicia.
Yeah.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear
Oh,
me?
good, good. Now I hear you perfectly.
Oh,
Yes,
okay. All right,
great.
great. Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Now tell me this. It's been a while since that show was on, which I thought was a great premise, Honey, We're Killing the Kids. How much ground have we gained in terms of a focus on true nutrition for children?
Oh, geez. Well, we hear a lot about it. The question is whether or not people are implementing it. I mean, that's like a whole other, that's a whole other story. I mean, we've gained some, groundwork. I think the challenge is knowing what we know about how to, prevent disease and doing it, and then, conversely, dealing with the notion or idea of, love yourself at any size and self-esteem and not body shaming people. I think there's a real fine line when it comes to children and weight that I think puts pediatricians in a really tough position.
Wow, that is an excellent point you just brought up that I have mixed feelings about in terms of yes, love yourself where you're at, but to just accept that as being fine and we can just stuff down all the donuts we want, I don't know that that's such a healthy attitude.
Well, look, the truth is if you're smoking excessively or you're using, drugs that you shouldn't be using or consuming too much alcohol, a doctor's going to tell you not to do that. I think the whole idea of weight and weight loss is daunting. Nobody wants to hurt anybody's feelings. And at the end of the day, a lot of physicians don't have enough training on how to give out advice to people on how to lose weight. So therefore, it just becomes this, should I bother saying anything or should I ignore it? You don't want to turn a parent off or get a kid upset and not have them come back. But the fact is, if you're overweight, you're statistically likely to, have other diseases or ailments associated with being overweight. I mean, we know that. So is it responsible or irresponsible medicine, to say something or not say something?
Yeah, that is confusing, and it becomes, almost politicized, like you're talking about with, are you shaming someone by pointing out? Well, anyway, it's complex. But I would say you, as a registered dietitian and having a doctorate and being so highly trained, would certainly be an appropriate person to help someone walk through how they might be healthier through the proper use of food.
Right, absolutely. And that is what I do. I do see patients in a private practice or clients in a private practice, and I do a lot of speaking, and I enjoy it because I always say the healthy choice is the easy choice. You just have to make it. So, feeling good to me is better than any food taste for a moment. There is nothing that is worth it, to sort of eat to compromise your health. I think about living vibrantly, and let's face it, every day we all get a little bit older, and I want to live as long as possible without any diseases, to be able to enjoy activities of daily living and, take care of my body as a frame, take care of my mind, take care of my heart, and keep spreading the good word.
And I think that's wise. Now, of course, the other thing to point out is let's say somebody does have almost an addiction to donuts, let's say, as an example, and it's very emotionally threatening to say to go on the path towards health, you could never have one again, but it
Right.
certainly may be appropriate to think about have it once a week instead of starting every day that way.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, I always talk to people about reduction. That's the best thing you could do is to slowly reduce the amount of servings of anything, whether it be a donut. I mean, look, I have patients that are addicted to diet soda, And I tell them all the time, you know, I don't think it's the best choice for them. Even though it doesn't have calories, it still triggers that sweet response, that sweet drive, that sweet addiction. So changing it for something that's slightly different doesn't mean it's better at all. So I usually tell people to cut back. Conversely, the opposite, you know, somebody who doesn't work out, I always say, what can we do to increase your physical activity every day? Not like, okay, you're going to go to the gym every day. Can you start with, can you do something once a week? Then the next week, can you do it twice a week? You know, if you don't drink water, can you start with one glass a day? And then can you increase it to two glasses a day?
I think that's excellent advice. And also, you know, the way you're modeling it and that you do it for yourself, like I do it for myself. So, you know, being a model of what choosing good health looks like, I think is really, really supportive for those people that you might consult with. You know, I was speaking to a nutritionist the other day, and she had just visited orphanages in Nepal. Now, wow. You would think Nepal's a pretty, you know, low-income place, yes? And
yes.
There's lots of orphans there. And do you know what they feed the orphans, which is not the highest level of society in Nepal, is all whole home-cooked food. So they actually feed them, you know, rice and beans with a little bit of free-range meat thrown in there. And if you look at something like what they feed children commercially in the food lunch programs in the United States, it's so much of a worse choice.
Well, I mean, it's hard to generalize every school food system. I know people that work in school nutrition that do a darn good job of providing. Sometimes those kids are getting better nutrition at school than they're getting at home. So I really, you know, I don't, again, I'm not going to throw out the baby with the bathwater here and make some generalizations. And I want to remind people, too, that a lot of times there are a lot of kids that go hungry, and the free or reduced school breakfast and lunch for some kids is the only time they get to eat.
Yes, so, that's true. But I'm wondering why so often what I see in schools is what they're being served are, let's say, pre-fried potato patties that are warmed up in a microwave situation. Why couldn't we use more whole fresh foods in those school lunch programs?
I think a lot of schools do. I know, you know, like when my children were at older ages in the public school system, they were able to buy whatever they wanted. I mean, they, you know, I hate to say it, but kids will always eat pizza and French fries when, you know, or something that's like a chicken tender. That will always be their go-to food. And if that's always available, then that's what they're going to choose because it tastes good and they like it. And a lot of times they've been conditioned to eat that. So, but a lot of schools do serve fruit and fresh vegetables. There's more and more of that is available, and more foods that are prepared on site versus being frozen or warmed up. And there are some school districts that don't even have cafeterias, so kids go out to eat. And there are kids that come to school with school lunches that are a lot worse than what's served at schools.
Well, that's a good point. And I have also seen that, too, that it depends on what the child is going to choose. But it's great if they do have healthier options because,
right.
You know, those tater tots and fried things, I really don't think is the best nutrition for anyone, and certainly not for growing children.
Right. I would agree, but I also think that school food service has come a long way, and it continues to improve year in and year out because parents demand that of school districts. I know people that work intimately with school food, you know, that work for school food service companies, and I've, you know, been at conferences where that has been discussed. So, if parents want to see better food choices, they can get more involved with their schools to insist that it happens. You know, at the end of the day, school food service has to make money. They're there to make money. And so they're going to make money off of what sells, not what doesn't sell.
That's true. One RD, she's been on my show here. Her name is Kathleen Jensen. And she actually worked at a facility that was very difficult because it was actually a facility for the criminally insane. You know, this is a rough population. And when she came in, they were being fed all just those commercial things. And she came in and saw a big, giant commercial kitchen, which many places have, including schools, and no real cooking was being done. So she initiated a change where they're actually bringing in cabbage from the local farms, all kinds of stuff locally. They're chopping it up. They're cooking it in these vast commercial kitchens that have always been there instead
That's
of just
wonderful.
warming up prefab things. And
Right.
what she was able to show after a year, there was a lot of pushback at first, as you can imagine, is just what you brought up, Felicia, that it was actually a cost savings.
Yeah.
Instead of costing more. And that's what then got the administration into being interested in backing what she wanted to do.
And perhaps there may have been some other improvements in the behavior of the people that were there. There may have been some
there
other
was.
Improvements.
She actually documented that the second year.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's where it's important to have somebody who knows how to actually do some research, actually helping to implement programs so that you can actually document that. And be able to show it so it's not just anecdotal, but you can actually show something very definitively.
And talking about that, one thing you wanted to share today, I thought was a great topic, and you're calling it food fact or scare tactic. And I love how you start out in your content talking about coffee, because I'm someone who drinks coffee. I love coffee. I actually spend a lot of money getting like the best coffee available. You know, I'm fortunate that I could make that choice. I don't do that with everything, but since it's a coffee, that's important to me. And then I make it at home. Actually, my husband does. He's the barrister of the house. And he makes even a little sign that says coffee of the day. And we use organic coffee, filtered water, and brown filters. So that's very different than something that is commercially made and put in a styrofoam cup. Nonetheless, every day you hear different supposedly facts about whether coffee is good for you or bad for you.
Right, right, right. It's funny because I'm writing an article for my blog, which I just launched a few weeks ago, about bias. I was talking about how people get confused or upset or frustrated when they feel that the science seemingly flip-flops. And, you know, what I like to point out to people, it's not that the people were wrong, you know, 10 years ago and now they're right. It's that the information has changed. We've been able to study something longer. Perhaps we have improvements in testing methods, methodology, where we can look for cause and effect and looking at direct relationships versus, you know, a lot of times what we have is correlation. You know, you look at epidemiology studies where they're looking at correlation, which doesn't mean causation. So something, you know, relates to something, you know, and you try to follow it or backtrack it after the fact instead of looking for cause and effect, or something that's done in animals is not the same in humans. So, you know, I'm relieved to know that coffee isn't so bad for you because I love coffee as well. And, you know, what we do know about coffee is that, you know, it has antioxidants in it. It's got B vitamins, folate, magnesium, potassium. Research has shown that coffee is linked to a decreased risk of type 2 diabetes, gallstones, and may protect the brain from Parkinson's and Alzheimer's diseases, which I know, especially Alzheimer's and dementia, those are really, really big hot topics now. And I feel like maybe it's now because I'm of the sandwich generation. So lots of my friends are dealing with parents that are having memory issues, and you know, it's sometimes it's a little difficult to pinpoint, you know, whether it's dementia or Alzheimer's, and you know, nobody really wants that. So, you know, what are some things that we can do to prevent that?
Right, and so that's so interesting that coffee would come up as perhaps protective, but it also depends on the person, because some people
right.
are very caffeine sensitive.
Correct.
So they may get, you know, more jittery and things like that from it. So they could choose not to use it.
Correct.
And then, like I said, there's difference in qualities of coffee, what kind of pesticides and herbicides they're sprayed with versus organically grown. I mean, there's a lot to consider, but it really has been in the last couple of years a lot of, let's say, positive headlines in the news about coffee consumption. And it's so great that you are a deep researcher, because you know so well that very often a big headline, even if it's in every newspaper, is not really what's supported by the exact research article they are referencing.
Correct. You know, and the other thing, too, is that there are things that make headlines that sometimes people just will take at face value. And there was just some research that came out the other day looking at foods that are good for the planet, you know, how to eat in a way that's healthy for the planet. But at the end, but they were advocating a lot of consumption of fish. And on the one hand, we tell people to eat fish, but I was at a conference where somebody made a statement that was very profound, that if we just didn't fish our oceans and seas for 1 year, we would completely restore the fish supply in our oceans and seas. So we are taking out at a rate that is disproportionate to what nature can replenish on its own. And that has also had an impact on some of the sublife in the seas, like the coral reefs and other, you know, sea animals or smaller, you know, animals that are in the oceans and seas. So, you know, we have to think about, like, well, what's really good for us and what's really good for the planet, and thinking about that, like, on a greater level.
Well, in terms of fish, I find that's a confusing issue as well, because, as I'm sure you know, the amount of mercury and toxic compounds is so high in some fish, particularly large fish like tuna, that
right.
There's actually a warning, and this is from mainstream medicine, that
right.
women who are pregnant should really limit their consumption of tuna because of the heavy metal toxicity.
Well, I'll tell you personally, I stopped eating swordfish in my 20s, you know, because of that. I started graduate school in my late 20s, and I think I recently ate it. Like, it's been over 25 years, if not 30 years, since I ate swordfish. And because of that, like, fear factor. So, you know, we have to be very careful about what we are telling people in terms of food and food safety. And I'm no longer of childbearing years, so I'm not as concerned about it. But for that reason, but just for my overall health, I really do tend to encourage people to eat more plant-based with smaller amounts of animal-sourced protein, which is what I call more of like a flexitarian diet.
Yeah, that's a very good word. In fact, I'm lecturing at a vegan conference in a couple days. And, you know, while I honor definitely making that choice, it's almost more like a religious choice, I feel.
Yeah.
But
uh-huh.
From the point of health, it's not always the best choice. And people do often develop different deficiencies. But nor do you need, you know, 12-ounce steak every day either.
Correct. Correct, correct. And some of the other foods I actually want to talk about are what I also consider sort of other good sources of protein, since you started talking about steak, that are relatively inexpensive, that also, you know, people get concerned about. One is eggs. You know, we've heard a lot in the past about eggs and cholesterol, and, you know, back in the 60s we were told not to eat eggs because they're high in cholesterol, they're going to raise our dietary, you know, our blood serum cholesterol levels. And, you know, what we learned in the 80s and 90s is that, you know, it's not so, you know, that the yolk, which is what a lot of people were avoiding, is really where all the nutrients are. The essential fatty acids are in there. A lot of the vitamins are in there. You know, the egg whites are just protein, but the yolk is where, you know, we find choline, we find lutein and zeaxanthin, which are important. And, you know, protein content for other foods is all compared to the protein levels or the amino acid levels in an egg. So, you know, I eat eggs all the time. I'm pretty much empty nesting, not to make fun of, like, eggs and birds, but I'm pretty much empty nesting. So, you know, I keep hard-boiled eggs on hand so that, because I'm the kind of person who has to remember to eat protein every day. If I'm not, you know, making sure I'm balancing out my vegetables to make sure I'm getting adequate amino acids. So it's very easy to eat a hard-boiled egg and keep them on hand.
I completely agree with you. What I do is I buy free-range eggs. Yes, they're about a dollar more expensive, but, you know, it's a dollar for
right.
12 eggs.
For
and
12
what
eggs,
I
right, do the math, right?
Is what, yeah, is what you said. I will actually hard-boil them. The whole dozen, and then mm-hmm. I have them in my grab-and-go bags because I mm-hmm. do not leave the house without food. And that's
yes.
one of the ways I have found that works so well to not I don't eat bagels, and I don't run in and get a piece of pizza. I just don't even want that. So what I want to have with me, if I don't have time to make a salad to go, I actually just bring romaine lettuce leaves and a hard-boiled egg and perhaps an organic rice cake and right. some nuts. And that is very satisfying.
Well, I'll tell you something that I make a lot. I will make egg salad with one egg and one hard-boiled egg, and I buy the mini avocados, and I mash those up together, and I put a little bit of sea salt and some herbs in there, and I just eat that plain, or I'll eat that on some crackers, like if you're mentioning you're eating the rice cakes, like that's a great sort of grab-and-go kind of food where I'm getting all kinds of really good nutrients, and, you know, I'm swapping out the avocado for mayonnaise. It's so much healthier. It's like getting a slice of a multivitamin.
It is. In fact, I just had before our show, I had a hard-boiled egg and guacamole. So there you go.
There you go.
The same thing. We're on that same page. We're going to take a little break here right now. Mm-hmm. And when we come back, we will be continuing our conversation with our brilliant guest, nutritionist and expert and author. And so many things that she knows. And she is Felicia Stoller. And Felicia, what's your website so people can start looking at it?
www.Felicia, F-E-L-I-C-I-A, Stoller, S-T-O-L-E-R.com.
And there's a lot of information there. We will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the folklore, history, chemistry, and medicinal applications of the common kitchen herb, thyme.
The common culinary spice known botanically as Thymus vulgaris is only one member of a large genera which includes over 400 species and even more varieties. The Thymus genera is originally native to the Mediterranean region and is a perennial plant which grows wild in usually dry, sandy soil, green heaths, and grasslands. Thyme is a prolific, fragrant, creeping ground cover and often displays an attractive spray of flowering branchlets spanning the spectrum from white to violet.
There is considerable debate amongst historians as to the origin of the name thyme. Some believe it to be from the Greek thymen, meaning to fumigate or to burn a sacrifice, because it was used as a sweet-smelling incense and also to keep pests and venomous creatures away from the Greek home. Others believe it came from the Greek thumos, meaning courage or energy, perhaps because it has a reputation of being used by Greek warriors for courage and was bathed in and used as a beverage for invigoration. The Egyptians used an herb called thyme, which we believe is Thymus vulgaris, to mummify their dead. The principal chemical constituents of thyme are the volatile oils consisting of phenol, thymol, and carvacrol. A 1977 article in the scientific journal Chemical Abstracts revealed that thymol's antimicrobial activity is 18 times more powerful than phenol. Phenol is a major antiseptic used in commercial germicidal cleaners like Lysol. Thymol is one of the most potent antimicrobial substances known and far surpasses even the strongest antibiotics. It has been illustrated in the Journal of Chemistry and in the Merck Index of Drugs and Chemicals to destroy parasites, worms, fungi, bacteria, mosquito larvae, and many viruses.
The pharmaceutical and cosmetic industry is privy to the important medicinal effects of oil of Thymus vulgaris. It is ubiquitously found in gargles, cough drops, vapor rubs, and many mouthwashes. Oil of thyme is to be used, albeit very sparingly because of its potency, as a gargle or mouthwash for sore throats and inflamed gums. Because the volatile oil is expelled via the lungs and kidneys, naturopathic physicians use it for upper respiratory infections and urinary tract infections. If you are in the midst of a cold and are lying in bed with too much thyme on your hands, try making a thyme tea made with just a few teaspoons of thyme to a cup of boiling water. It's an excellent diaphoretic because it causes the body to perspire profusely. Thyme also possesses an excellent carminative and antispasmodic effect, helping in poor digestion, flatulence, and intestinal gripe.
So, listeners, if you're feeling ill, thyme heals all wounds. Remember to reach for that thyme in a bottle the next time you open up the natural medicine chest.
Again, two more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Find us at naturalnurse.com. Click on calendar to find all the events or register for the newsletter by going to the bottom left-hand corner. And you can find us on Facebook at Facebook The Natural Nurse. Today, we have as our guest, nutritional expert, America's health and wellness expert, Felicia Stoller. And Felicia, you told us your website, FeliciaStoller.com. You mentioned your blog and that you just started that. Where
yes.
can people, you know, get your blog?
Sure. Well, actually, if you click on my regular website, it'll take you to the blog. There's a hyperlink there. It's just called America's Health and Wellness Expert is my blog, which is, you know, a trademark that I got a few years ago. My first blog that I posted was about fasting, and I'm working on one right now about bias, so that should be up shortly. But I'm hoping to have other things like tips that I talk about when I do these segments. For a long time, I've considered myself a microblogger and curator of other information where people know that I'm a trusted source so that when I'm retweeting things or reposting things that I see in the media, you know, they know that, you know, and when I'm commenting on it, that there's, you know, a reason for that because, as you were discussing before, I'm trained in medical journalism as well. And I like to think of myself being sort of like that. I scan the media every day looking for, you know, stories and seeing how things are being covered as they relate to nutrition, fitness, health, preventative health, exercise, and so disease prevention. So I'm often, you know, trying to share that information with people. So, you know, that's why I have a bit of a blog that I'm going to be doing. Mm-hmm.
And I also find, you know, some of your quasi information really interesting in terms of when information is released, knowing where it's coming from and what is their agenda. For example, you talk about some pretty well-known places such as the Cornucopia Institute and PETA, P-E-T-A.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
What was your viewpoint on that, and how would people know if that is the source of the information or not?
You know, it's very hard for people to know that, like, PETA also funds the Physicians for Responsible, the PCRM, the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, which a lot of times I do like a lot of what they put out, but they do have a bias. And I often say to people, you have to be real careful about what the bias is, that sometimes industries have financial gain by dissing somebody else. And you have to be very cautious about that. And to the average consumer, they don't know, they don't recognize that there's propaganda out there. So, for example, the Cornucopia Institute has gone to great lengths to discredit an ingredient called carrageenan, which is from basically it's a plant fiber that comes from red seaweed, which is used as a stabilizer. It's used a lot in dairy products like in yogurts. It's in shakes. It's in cottage cheese. You know, again, naturally occurring, sustainably produced, been around for a long time. A friend of mine and I were talking about carrageenan, and she's Irish. She's like, you know, in Ireland, they call that Irish moss.
Yes.
That in areas where, in areas where the soil quality was poor, they used a lot of the carrageenan to help grow potatoes. So that really helped. But not only did it help to grow potatoes, but people ate it too. So, you know, to turn around and to try to go to great lengths to take an ingredient and discredit it and to get the science, you know, it gets very confusing to talk about carrageenan and then trying to relate it to polygenin and whether it occurs or doesn't occur and causes cancer, doesn't cause cancer. You know, they've gone to, the Cornucopia Institute's gone to great lengths to discredit this ingredient or this food, but yet at the end of the day, there's no science out there saying that there's anything bad about it. The FDA has thrown it out a few times. And in fact, there is research looking at carrageenan and the positive health benefits that we know from human clinical studies. Again, I was talking before about studies being done in humans versus animals, that it may help to lower cholesterol, which totally makes sense because it's a plant fiber, reduces inflammation, and may help with fighting colds and flu viruses by reducing the amount of time that you're sick. And, you know, as somebody who's had a cold that's been lingering for weeks, you know, anything I can do to help reduce that, you know, I want to do that. So, like, I was going to talk about carrageenan being an ingredient that's been demonized, but a lot of times it's found in yogurts, and some people think you shouldn't have yogurt because of things that are added. And the things that I like to tell people to stay away from are added sugars, any of the candies that are on top of yogurts. You know, you don't need crushed Oreos to get you to eat yogurt. And, you know, and some of the non-nutritive sweeteners that are out there, as I've said before, aren't necessarily any better. And, you know, I remember as a young girl seeing all those commercials, you know, the Dan, I think they were Dan and yogurt commercials showing, you know, the
yeah,
Russians
many years ago, that's all that was
years
there.
Old, right? The dancing Russians, you know, like if you ate yogurt, you'd live to be like, you know, older and still be physically active. I mean, I think yogurt is also another great, dairy products can be a great form of protein that's inexpensive. I love yogurt. I eat it a lot. I use that as a replacement for sour cream in a lot of dishes. And, you know, I think even like with cereal, sometimes it's a little heartier than pouring milk in your cereal if you're going to have cereal to help keep you fuller a little bit longer. So, you know, again, like people get into this whole like, well, you shouldn't have dairy. Humans weren't meant to have dairy. Well, you know what? We've modified our food supply, and we've harnessed how to produce food to keep people alive. And if it weren't for dairy, we may not be alive. You know, when people figured out how to take the milk of a mammal and use it for food to feed a village or to feed groups of people instead of slaughtering the animal, you know, you could keep people alive a lot longer. I mean, if you go back to the days of the Bible, I mean, whatever, whether it's Old Testament or the New Testament, herding has been around, and as in H-E-R-D-I-N-G, has been around for a long time, and people have been consuming the dairy, you know, the byproduct of mammals for quite some time.
Yes, that's good information. But there is, for instance, when we were talking about carrageenan, which has been called Irish moss, but there are different forms. Sometimes there's one that is Irish moss, and there's another kind that actually is more of a chemically made component, which might have a different action. How would you know the difference between one or the other?
Well, the issue is it really carrageenan or is it something else? And I think that's where the problem is, and some of the misinformation lies that it's not carrageenan being the problem.
Well, that's a good way, but you wouldn't know from a label.
Well, a label would say carrageenan on it. The other stuff that is alluded to are polygenins, and they're not actually substances that are used as a food, as an additive, without getting too much into the biochemistry of it.
That's good information, though.
Yeah, it is. It's sort of a byproduct of some other process, and it's not related to carrageenan. So just because it sounds the same doesn't mean it's the same.
So just like another one that perhaps you have something to say about is xylitol, mm-hmm. because xylitol is something that's popping up a lot, is a sweetener in gums and foods,
right.
And it can be sourced different ways. Originally, when we started seeing it in the market back in the 90s, it was mostly from birch tree bark, but now it's mostly from corn. And of course, if it's from corn, it's genetically modified corn in many cases. But also, although they say it's non-toxic, I am not so happy with the amount of liver disease in dogs that is being caused by them sort of gobbling up xylitol gum packs.
Dogs are eating xylitol gum packs?
Yes, and they're getting actually having to have liver transplants or dying.
Oh, gee, I'm not familiar with that. I have to say that my my tend to do more with humans than with pets, but that's certainly something I will look into. But xylitol is a sugar alcohol, and, you know, a lot of those products, you know, xylitol was really popular, especially for people with diabetes. You know, we've even learned more about diabetes and diabetics and sugar alcohols and non-nutritive sweeteners and how that, you know, affects diabetics. And, you know, people think that, you know, just eating sugar or carbohydrates, you know, is going to cause diabetes. And if it were that easy, then taking it out would make diabetes go away. And we know that that's not the case. But people There are people that have difficulty digesting sugar alcohols that do complain of gas and other stomach pains as a result of xylitol. So, you know, sometimes I have to say to people, like, look at the food label. The other ingredients that sometimes can cause that are other fibers, for example, beyond sugar alcohols being a problem for people, like sorbitol. People also sometimes have a problem with. Sometimes people have issues with things like inulin, which is used a lot as a fiber to go into foods, and that does cause people tremendous GI distress, so they can't figure out, like, why am I getting such bad gas when I ate, you know, that food. And you really have to, you know, I kid around when I used to teach at Rutgers. I'm not teaching there right now, but I used to tease the students that I went to grad school to be able to pronounce all the ingredients on food labels, you know, because sometimes, you know, foods have such extensive ingredients. But, you know, if you eat food close to the way it's found in nature, you know, you go buy a bag of spinach, you don't have to worry about anything else that's added in there. It's just spinach, right?
Well, that's a very, very good point and something I highly recommend, which is paragraph free. Like,
right.
Don't eat things with paragraphs on them. What does that mean? No packaged food. And it's really not that hard to do. And
right.
When you are buying packaged food, do read the paragraph and do now with online, you know, nothing's a mystery. If there's a word that you don't recognize on there, it's probably not good, but you can always just look it up.
Oh, well, be careful about what if you don't recognize a word, because sometimes one of the other, like, naughty food, you know, naughty ingredients that, you know, people villainize is ascorbic acid. You know, a few dietitians and I tell these funny stories about people going, oh, my goodness, there's ascorbic acid in there. It's like, oh, my gosh, it's just vitamin C. It's probably fruit juice that was in there. You know, what do people use when they want to, you know, they're making fruit salad and they don't want an apple to turn brown. They put lemons on it. Or what do we put in guacamole to prevent the avocado from turning brown, right, and oxidizing? A lot of times we use lime juice in there, and that's what ascorbic acid is. So sometimes I don't want people to be, you know, alarmed by words that are not familiar to them, because sometimes they're not really bad.
Right, but with the internet now, you do not have to have your long list of degrees and certificates to look it
right.
up. If there's
right.
something that you're wondering, what could this be, just look it up.
And you might, like me, need a pair of readers, because sometimes the ingredients are so small you can't read the label.
That's true. But I would say that's why, you know, moving your diet to being paragraph free for the most part, like you were talking about before. An avocado, you're holding it, it's an avocado. An egg, you're holding it, it's an egg. They don't have ingredient labels.
Right, right, right.
But and the spinach, you know, that you're talking about.
I will say once in a while I do like to cheat and buy canned beans, because it does make my cooking time a little quicker.
Oh, I think so. I think so. And there's some really good pre-cooked beans on the markets, even in glass jars besides
yep.
cans. And
yep.
that actually is a great way to increase your protein and not increase your kitchen time, which many people actually don't have a lot of kitchen time available. So I
right.
think that's true. But if you look on those jars, like let's say pre-cooked beans, they'll very often say beans, comma, water, comma, salt. That's it.
Right.
No big paragraph.
Right. And if you want to get the sodium out while we're talking about beans, all you have to do is soak them in water. You know, you take the canned beans and throw them into a bowl and add some water to it, and you keep rinsing that out a few times, and you can drain and pull out a lot of the salt out of the beans, because the water is attracted, you know, the salt is attracted to the water, too.
Oh, that's a great tip, and it only takes seconds.
Yes.
Take another
yes.
break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. You'll get to hear about other shows, because we're coming to you on Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, and we have lots of call numbers. Like, you could listen to this show just on a telephone, and many people do. Or you can actually call in with a question on our special voicemail line. So Progressive Radio Network is huge all over the world and really the largest station of its kind. We are very proud and happy to be part of the Progressive Radio Network team of voices that come at you 24/7. And we'll take a little break here, and then we'll come back with more from expert nutritionist Felicia Stoller.
Hi everyone, I'm Gary Null, the the founder of the Progressive Radio Network. Today we have more than 80 producers bringing forth the most progressive and most liberating information, the kind of information you do not regularly hear on any of the mainstream or alternative media. You can help us now. Up to this point, I have virtually supported the Progressive Radio Network, all of its expenses and payroll, myself. But we would like to expand our reach. We'd like to do far more. We'd like to be able to advertise on Facebook and let others know we exist. We are the number one Progressive Radio Network in the world. In fact, we have programs that are most listened to in all of Progressive Radio. But we could go a lot further. Our message could reach a lot more people, especially at a time when people are desperate for honest, objective insights on the important topical issues of our day. How can you help? It's simple. Go to prn.fm, go to our main page. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a little button, Support Now. And then whatever you can contribute on a monthly basis will make a big difference. It will help get the message out. It will help inform more people, give them more choices. This is where you'll hear in the independent candidates and the people looking to challenge the corruption in government and industries. But we need to get our reach out further. So please, whatever you can afford on a monthly basis, and there's some suggestions there, and it'll be automatic. All right, thank you very much for continuing to help us help you and the rest of the world on these important issues.
Hey, it's Jesse, PRN station manager. I have an exciting announcement for our amazing listeners. PRN has a new voicemail line that will allow you to connect better with our hosts. If you can't listen live but have a question or comment for one of our hosts, just call 862-800-6805. That's 862-800-6805. This feature will allow your voice to be heard on your favorite PRN show.
Thank you for listening to the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And thank you so much for joining us. You can find us at naturalnurse.com and also Facebook, The Natural Nurse. You can find our books. We have a variety of books. One is called Arthritis, The Alternative Medicine Definitive Guide. We have one called Weight Loss, The Alternative Medicine Definitive Guide. We have the Natural Medicine Chest, which right now is only available in Kindle because we sold thousands of copies when we did our Remedies Summit. So that we had 300,000 attendees. Those books are not available. We're reprinting them, but they are still available as a Kindle book. We have an ebook called Vitality and Virility, that's actually available as an ebook or a hardcover. And we also have supplements for pain available both ways. So you can check those out online. Today we have as our guest nutritionist Felicia Stoller, and she has a doctorate in nutrition and a long list of degrees. You're kind of, Felicia, a learning junkie, I would say.
Oh, yeah, I love to learn. I mean, it's so funny. I mean, every day I'm, you know, reading something, looking something up. I did 23andMe a few months ago, and I periodically will fill out continued questionnaires for them because I believe in being an important part of science. Even though I think some people are concerned about it, I like participating in it, and it asks, like, whether or not I read books. And I'm like, I don't read books, but I'm reading journal articles. I'm reading stuff online all the time. I kind of sometimes miss that paper, but I'm always learning. There isn't a day that goes by that I don't think I'm enriching my knowledge base by learning something new or improving my understanding in different areas.
Yeah, I would have to say I have that affliction myself. Now, in terms of that, what you talked about 23andMe, so that's a genetic discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And you probably have heard of the theory, you know, of a book that talks about Eat Right for Your Type. And it seemed to look at some kind of connection between past genetics and heritage and foods that might be best for you. So do you find any truth in that theory?
Well, honestly, that's one of my least favorite books. It's been out for a long time because humans across different continents have had different blood types, so it's really kind of hard to sort of whittle that down. And when you look at 23andMe and sort of go back and look at and really go and look at where people are from and the origin, I mean, we all eventually sort of like left Africa, so the African continent. So I don't really, you know, necessarily agree with a lot of that. I do think that, like, genetically, we are predisposed to different diseases and ailments, and there's some people looking at how we actually metabolize ingredients, which I think is absolutely fascinating. I mean, that was the first genetic test I had a year ago. It was for a company up in Canada that was doing supplements based upon your genetics and how you metabolize ingredients, and they feel that they could up or down regulate things based upon that. So if you think about that in terms of drugs and drug trials and whether or not things are effective, like we were talking about caffeine before, as an ingredient, you know, some people are very sensitive to caffeine, whereas other people are not. And maybe, perhaps, you know, when we look at drugs and whether or not they're effective at diseases, depending on whether or not we can metabolize the ingredients in those drugs, maybe what it's about, not necessarily about whether or not it actually, you know, it's effective for that disease or not. You know, when you look at why something does or doesn't work, you know, when we do especially randomized controlled trials, right, and some people have the intervention and some people have a placebo. You know, if somebody has the intervention and it doesn't work, is it because it's not effective at doing what it's supposed to do, or is it just because that individual doesn't metabolize that ingredient in a way that allows it to work properly?
And it would be great to be able to test that ahead of time. As a matter of fact, Rudolf Steiner, who was very well known and created a lot of different systems in health and wellness, he actually had a sophisticated blood test that was used in the hospitals in the 1940s when they were still, most medicines were herbs, of course, that's what we had. And
right.
What they did was take a drop of blood and then put the herb or prospective therapy into the drop of blood and allowed it to dry. And they could see under the microscope what kind of coagulation response they got in that individual. And if it was something that was very smooth and kind of looked like a nice cohesive crystal when it was solidified, the person usually reacted quite well to that intervention. While if they used it and got a very scattered looking response, then it would be something that wasn't good for that individual. So it saved a lot of people from going through the trial and error of trying it and finding out that wasn't for them.
Right, right, right. Yeah, so, you know, I mean, look, there's lots of beliefs out there. At the end of the day, people need to make, you know, better for you food choices, be physically active, get adequate sleep, and minimize stress, and hopefully live life with a lot of love in your heart.
Yeah, those are wonderful recommendations. And there's a lot of controversy. Did you get any surprises? I just want to ask you personally. You don't have to tell them what we.
Oh no, I don't mind at all. I actually I talk about it very freely. I'll probably do a blog post about it too, because I know that I have a very strong familial history with heart disease, and I was actually surprised that the markers for that or the precursors as far as genetics did not exist. So when I got my results back, I sent it to all my family members and I said, hey, all this stuff that you guys have, all the stuff my grandparents died of, it was all because of lifestyle behavior choices. The way everybody ate, the lack of physical activity, the smoking, the drinking, whatever it was, that's what caused it. It was not, you know,
in the family. Maybe it's more
correct.
That it runs in the family, a certain lifestyle,
well,
not the genes.
Well, right. I mean, the things that, you know, apparently run in my that were in my genetics that I think make me more sensitive to, but I don't, to be aware of, but I'm like, I could knock on this piece of wood next to me at my great grandmother's table that's next to me right now. I don't have a problem with it, but it's that I could have a, you know, predisposition to being lactose intolerant and or having celiac disease. So guess what? Like, I'll take those two. Luckily, I can have wheat without a problem, and I obviously have no issue with dairy, so I'm very happy about that. But it was good to know. I mean, so in terms of anything surprising, that was about it, but because nobody's ever seemingly had issues with it. But you know, again, I just found it very interesting.
So you would recommend that it's not like a scary thing for people to find out, at least not from, I know a lot of people say, I don't want to know, you know.
Right, like I had a lengthy conversation with one of my best friends from childhood. You know, we're going to be 52 years old. She's adopted. She doesn't know anything about her genetics. We talked about a breast cancer scare that she just had. And I said, you know, don't you think it's worth, like, running a test and doing that? And she's like, well, you know, I don't know. You know, people are concerned about privacy, about how that might impact things like life insurance or health insurance with pre-existing conditions. And, you know, just because you carry a gene doesn't mean you're going to manifest something.
That's true. But finding out that you do, I think, could perhaps be supportive of taking what you're talking about, common sense preventive actions.
Right. And not only common sense actions, but, you know, there may just be things that makes you a little bit more aware or more sensitive to monitoring so that you know, or down the road, if some treatment comes out that can help prevent something, wouldn't you want to be a part of that? So I think knowledge is power. I've always said that I think knowledge is power, and I think it allows people to make informed decisions about things in their life, whereas if you just want to play Russian roulette and, you know, not worry about it, that's fine. But again, I spend so much time talking about disease prevention and how to prevent illness and disease that, you know, for me, I'm just a big science geek. So that's why I care less about my privacy when it comes to that. And I, you know, and that's why I do participate. Like, I always get this thing, I've participated in 96, you know, more than 96% of the people that have even done 23andMe, I've continued to participate in their health questionnaires, because I think it's important to have this information, and I think it's important to be part of a bigger scientific study that's out there in order to actually look at relationships with food and physical activity, and even some of the stuff we were talking about. Like, I was looking at some of the questions that were on there and the way people eat and not eat. Even by the questions that are being asked, it really tells me a lot about the way people eat, about the soda consumption they have, the lack of fruits and vegetables that they have, the amounts of sweets and frozen treats that people might be consuming. You know, really, like, even based on the questions, it's like, wow, people must be eating a lot of this other stuff that I'm not.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest today, nutritionist and health, America's health and wellness expert, and that is Felicia Stoller. You can find her at FeliciaStoller.com, and you can link right to her blog with her up-and-coming information. So thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you for having me. I always appreciate it. It's always my pleasure.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us once again for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z right here on Progressive Radio Network. Until next time, this is Ellen Kamai at naturalnurse.com, hoping that you stay healthy.